Then the full story rarely surfaced. Each Mossad chief wondered how to penetrate the veil. But various attempts by both the government of Israel and Mossad to establish a good working relationship with the Vatican had been politely but firmly rejected. The reality was that within the Holy See's Secretariat of State, the equivalent of a secular foreign office, there existed a powerful anti-Israeli faction. Every Friday evening, the CIA station chief in Rome brought to the Apostolic Palace the latest secrets obtained from satellite surveillance and electronic eavesdropping by CIA field agents. No other foreign leader had access to the intelligence the Pope received. It enabled the most political of all modern pontiffs to stamp his distinctive style and authority on both the church and the secular world. Papal diplomacy, the political core of a highly centralized Vatican bureaucracy, had more than at any time in its 500 years of very active history become deeply involved with international events. As a world leader, this involvement had nearly cost the Pope his life when he was almost assassinated in St. Peter's Square on May 13, 1981. 2 years later, on November 15, 1983, a cold winter's night in Rome, John Paul was about to learn the answer to a question which still consumed him. Who had ordered the assassination? Every moment of what had happened had been seared forever into his memory and remained as vivid as the scar tissue from his bullet wounds. There had been about 100,000 people in St. Peter's Square on that Wednesday afternoon, May 13, 1981. They were packed within the three-quarter circle encompassing Bernini's colonnades. What went on in the mind of a swarthy young Turk, Mehmet Ali Aksa, would not be known. He had arrived in the square in mid-afternoon and worked his way close to the path along which the Popemobile would trundle. Aksa had been a member of a terrorist group based in Turkey, which called itself the Grey Wolves. But he had left their ranks and traveled through the Middle Eastern training camps of extreme Islamic fundamentalist groups. Now he was almost at the end of his journey. Aksa was in St. Peter's Square not to praise, but to kill the Pope. At 4 o'clock, John Paul had changed into a freshly pressed, pristine white silk cassock. On the advice of the CIA, the garment had been cleverly modified to enable a flak jacket to be worn undetected beneath the garment. John Paul had refused to wear the protection. John Paul descended to the San Damaso courtyard inside the Apostolic Palace at 4:50 p.m. The immediate protection of the pontiff was in the hands of blue-suited vigili. The Vatican's small but highly trained security force, with the sharp eyes behind the ceremonial Swiss guards, already positioned in St. Peter's Square. Parked in the courtyard was the Popemobile, or Campagnola, with its white leather padded seat and handrail for the Pope to grip during his progress through the vast piazza. Gathered around the vehicle were senior members of his staff. McGee would remember that John Paul was in unusually good form. At 5 o'clock precisely, the Popemobile drove out of the courtyard. Ahead from St. Peter's Square, the cheering began. As the Campagnola approached the Arch of the Bells, the vigili were joined by Rome's city policemen, who walked ahead and immediately behind the vehicle. As the Popemobile emerged into the piazza, the crowd noise rose to a roar. John Paul waved and smiled. His time as an actor in his youth had given him a powerful stage presence. At 2 miles an hour, the Pope turning from one side to the other, the vehicle moved toward the Egyptian obelisk in the center of the piazza. At exactly 5:15 p.m., the Campagnola began a second circuit of the square under the watchful eyes of Chibin. The security chief was trotting behind the Popemobile. The crowd's cheering was even wilder. Impetuously, John Paul did something which always made Chibin nervous. The Pope reached into the crowd and plucked out a child. He hugged and kissed the little girl and then handed her back to her ecstatic mother. At 5:17 p.m., he once more reached out to touch the head of another little girl, dressed in communion white. Then he straightened and looked about him as if wondering who else he might greet. It was his way of personalizing the papacy in even the largest of crowds. At 5:18 p.m., The first shot rang out in St. Peter's Square. John Paul remained upright, his hands still gripping the handrail. Then he started to sway. Mehmet Ali Aksa's first bullet had penetrated his stomach, creating multiple wounds in the small intestine, the lower part of the colon, the large intestine, and the mesentery, the tissue which holds the intestine to the abdominal wall. Instinctively, John Paul placed his hand over the entry wound to try to stop the spurting blood. His face increasingly filled with pain, and he slowly began to collapse. Only seconds had passed since he had been hit. Aksa's second bullet struck the pontiff in his right hand, which fell uselessly to his side. Bright red blood spurted over his white cassock. A third 9mm bullet hit John Paul higher up on the right arm. The Campagnola driver twisted in his seat, his mouth open, too stunned to speak. Chibin was screaming at him to move. A papal aide shielded the Pope with his own body. The vehicle began to lurch forward. The crowd itself was swaying as if buffeted by a giant wind. One shocking sentence rippled outward from the scene of carnage. In a score of different languages came the same disbelieving words, "The Pope has been shot." Chibin and his Vatican security men and City of Rome policemen were waving their guns, shouting orders and counter-orders, looking for the gunman. Aksa had burst through the crowd, running very fast, holding his gun in his right hand. The crowd continued to open before his waving pistol. Suddenly, he tossed the gun away. At the same moment, his legs were cut from beneath him. A Rome police officer had made the arrest. In a moment, both men were buried beneath other policemen in a scene that resembled a rugby scrum. Several policemen kicked and punched Aksa before he was dragged away to a police van. The Popemobile had continued at an agonizingly slow speed toward the nearest ambulance stationed by the Vatican's bronze door. But the ambulance had no oxygen equipment, so the Pope was transferred to a second ambulance nearby. Vital moments were lost. Lights flashing and sirens wailing, the ambulance raced to Rome's Gemelli Hospital, the nearest to the Vatican, completing the journey in a record 8 minutes. During the drive, the Pope uttered no sound of despair or resentment, only words of profound prayer. "Mary, my mother, Mary, my mother." At the hospital, he was rushed to a 9th-floor surgical suite that comprised an induction room, an operating room, and a recovery area. Here, at the center of the crisis, there was no panic, no wasted movement or word. All was quiet urgency and tightly controlled discipline. Here, the stricken pontiff could have felt the beginning of hope. His blood-stained cassock, vest, and underpants were expertly cut away, and the blood-stained cross on its solid gold chain was removed. Surgical towels were draped over his nakedness. Gloved hands reached for, fetched, and carried the first of the instruments needed in a struggle the surgical team was only too familiar with. When he had recovered after almost 6 hours of surgery, John Paul believed he had been saved by the miraculous intervention of one of the most revered apparitions in the Catholic world, the Virgin of Fatima, whose feast day was the same one as the attempt on his life. During his long months of recovery, John Paul became increasingly preoccupied with who had ordered him to be assassinated. He tried to read every scrap of evidence that came from police and intelligence agencies as diverse as the CIA, West Germany's BND, and the security services of Turkey and Austria. It was impossible to read it all. There were millions of words of reports, statements, and assessments. Not one document answered fully John Paul's question. Who had wanted him killed? He was still no wiser when Aksa stood trial at the Rome Assize Court in the last week of July 1981. The brisk 3-day hearing cast no light on the gunman's motives. Aksa was sentenced to life imprisonment. With good behavior, he would be eligible for parole in the year 2009. 2 years after Aksa had been convicted, John Paul had finally been promised the answer to the question which still festered in his mind. It would come from a priest he trusted above all others. His title was Nuncio Apostolico con Incarici Speciali. The words offered no real clue that Archbishop Luigi Poggi was the natural heir to the world of secret papal politics, with special responsibility for gathering intelligence from communist Europe. People in the Vatican simply called him the Pope's spy. For many months, Poggi had been involved in very secret contacts with Mossad. A few days before, there had been another meeting, again in Vienna, a city both Poggi and the officer liked as a background for their clandestine contacts. It was from that meeting that Poggi was returning to the Vatican on that icy November night in 1983. He was bringing with him the answer to the Pope's question: who had ordered Aksa to try to murder him? One of the massive gates of the Arch of the Bells was already closed, the prelude to the nightly ritual of locking all the entrances to the Vatican on the stroke of midnight, when the dark blue Fiat limousine crunched across the cobblestones, its lights picking out the two Swiss guards caped against the chill. The car was expected, and the figure behind the wheel was the familiar one of a Vatican chauffeur. But after the assassination attempt on the Pope, no one was taking any chances. The car drove past the side of St. Peter's Basilica and bounced over the cobblestones of San Damaso Courtyard before stopping outside the main entrance to the Apostolic Palace. The driver jumped out and opened the door for his passenger. Archbishop Luigi Poggi emerged, dressed in severe black, a scarf covering the white flash of his collar. Physically, he bore a resemblance to Rafi Eitan, the same powerful shoulders and biceps, the same rolling gait, and eyes which could be as cold as this night. Few recent trips matched the importance of what Poggi had finally been told at the meeting in Vienna's old Jewish quarter. There, in a narrow, steep-roofed building, a few blocks from Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal's offices, the Archbishop had listened raptly to a man they had agreed would only be called by his first name, Eli. Poggi was now well used to such precautions in his dealings with Mossad. The only personal detail he knew about Eli was that he spoke several languages and had finally answered the question of who had orchestrated the attempt on John Paul's life. Over 2 decades, Poggi had provided pontiffs with details that enabled them to better evaluate information from other sources. The Archbishop had that ability, rare even among diplomats, to produce a balanced and swift assessment of material from a dozen sources in almost as many languages, most of which he spoke fluently. In his next meeting with Eli, Poggi had spoken in the soft voice that was long his trademark, his brown eyes watchful, lips pursed before putting a new question, his composed appearance never changing. But on that cold winter's night, no doubt physically tired from his travels, he could be forgiven a bounce in his step. Walking into the Apostolic Palace, past the duty vigili and the Swiss guards who sprang to attention as he passed, Poggi took the elevator to the papal apartments. The Pope's butler showed Poggi into John Paul's study. The room's bookshelves offered clues to the Pope's expanding interests, along with leather-bound Polish editions of the classics and the works of theologians and philosophers, were copies of various military titles. The pontiff had unswerving conviction that the main enemy the world still faced in 1983 was Soviet communism. Pope John Paul had never lost an opportunity to tell his personal staff that before the new millennium dawned, something decisive would sweep the world. To all their questions as to what that event would be, he had refused to amplify, shaking his massive head and saying they must all pray that the Church would not lose more ground to communism or the secularism sweeping countries like the United States, Germany, and Holland. He insisted his life had been spared in St. Peter's Square to lead the fight back. Poggi knew that it was this concern, more than any other, which had affected John Paul both mentally and physically. Greetings over, Poggi could not have failed to notice that away from public gaze, John Paul had become more withdrawn. Aksa's bullets had not only shattered bone and tissue, but had created emotional scars that had left the Pope introspective and at times remote. Seated with both hands on his knees, the position Poggi always assumed when there was grave news to impart, the Archbishop began to unfold a story which had begun in those first weeks after Aksa had shot John Paul. When news of what had happened in St. Peter's Square on the afternoon of May 13, 1981, reached Tel Aviv, the immediate reaction of Mossad's Director General, Yitzhak Hofi, was that the shooting had been the work of a crank. Shocking though the incident in Rome had been, it had no direct bearing on Mossad's current concerns. Also at that time, Mossad Director Admoni began to explore the CIA's current involvement with the papacy. President Reagan and the pontiff had proclaimed their united opposition to abortion. The United States blocked millions of dollars of aid to countries that ran family planning programs. The Pope, through a purposeful silence, supported U.S. military policies, including supplying NATO with a new generation of cruise missiles. The CIA regularly bugged the phones of bishops and priests in Central America who advocated liberation theology and opposed U.S.-backed forces in Nicaragua and El Salvador. The phone transcripts formed part of the Pope's Friday briefing by the Rome CIA station chief. Reagan had also personally authorized Colonel Oliver North, then working for the National Security Council, to make regular and substantial payments to priests the Vatican deemed loyal in Central and South America, Africa, and Asia. The money was used to support their often lavish lifestyles and promote the Holy See's opposition to birth control and divorce. Intrigued by the Pope's ability to switch from temporal to spiritual matters, Mossad's Admoni used his personal friendship with Secretary of State Alexander Haig. They had met when Admoni worked out of the Israeli embassy in Washington to obtain a copy of the CIA's psycho profile of John Paul. It was a portrait of a man whose religious fervor could be so intense that he would cry out when praying and would often be found on the marble floor of his private chapel, face down, arms extended to form a cross, as still as in death. He could spend hours in that prone position, yet his anger could be eruptive and fearful to behold. Then he would storm and shout. His grasp of geopolitics was formidable, and he could be as unflinching as any dictator. John Paul was also not afraid to confront the Curia, the Vatican civil service, or his long-serving Secretary of State, Agostino Casaroli. The profile concluded that John Paul was highly politicized from his Polish experiences and that he relishes being a player on the world stage. For Nahum Admoni, one matter was clear. The close and self-serving ties between the CIA and the Pope had played a crucial role in John Paul coming to accept the American view that the attempt on his life had been organized by the Kremlin. Yet, supposing that standpoint could be demonstrated to be wrong, how would the Pope react? Would that shatter his faith in the CIA, make him wary of all intelligence services? And would it allow Mossad, if it could show there was another hand behind the attempted assassination, to finally find a way past the Vatican's bronze door and, if not admitted as a fully-fledged secret secular advisor to the papacy, at least be granted a hearing for its information, and in return, hopefully be able to revise the Holy See's attitude to Israel. 6 months later, the answer to Admoni's first question, had someone else masterminded the attempted assassination, was established to his satisfaction. The plot had been prepared in Tehran, with the full approval of Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Killing the Pope was intended as the opening move in a jihad, holy war, against the West, and what Khomeini saw as its decadent values being approved by the largest Christian church. Mossad's investigation had discovered that after his prison escape, Aksa was spirited into Iran, where he spent months in various training camps being indoctrinated. From its own sources in those camps, Mossad had pieced together a picture of Aksa's life at that time. He arose before dawn, his small red-rimmed eyes set deep in a long face, watchful as the other recruits awoke. The first light of day showed posters on the walls of their hut, photographs of the Ayatollah Khomeini, and revolutionary slogans each designed to fire their fantasies. Songs piped through the hut's loudspeakers reinforced this. Clad in vest and shorts, Aksa was an unprepossessing figure. Large hands and feet were all out of proportion to his body with his concave chest, protruding shoulder blades, and skinny arms and legs. The first thing he did each morning, like the other recruits, was to spread his prayer rug and prostrate himself 3 times, each time touching his forehead to the ground, murmuring the name of Allah, Master of the world, the all-meaningful and all-compassionate, the supreme sovereign of the Last Judgment. His instructors had taught him to reduce that hatred to one instantly recognizable image, a man dressed in white, living in a huge palace far beyond the mountains. Supported by pomp and glory, rejoicing in even more titles than Allah, the man was known variously as servant of the servants of God, patriarch of the West, vicar of Christ on earth, bishop of Rome, sovereign of the state of Vatican City, supreme pontiff, His Holiness, Pope John Paul II. Mehmet Ali Aksa had been promised that when the time came, he would be given a chance to kill the Pope. A month later, on December 23, 1983, at 4:30 a.m., almost 3 hours before the lights on the Christmas tree in St. Peter's Square would be switched off for the day, the Pope was awoken by his valet. The bedroom was surprisingly small, its walls still lined with a pastel linen covering his predecessor favored. The wooden floor, gleaming from being polished, was partly covered by a rug woven by Polish nuns. On the wall above the bed, in which 4 of John Paul's predecessors had lain waiting for death, was a crucifix. On another wall was a fine painting of Our Lady. Both were gifts from Poland. In addition to the Pope's valet, those who saw him at this hour, usually one of his administrative priests, with the news which could not wait, were relieved to see John Paul had regained some of his old vigor and vitality. As always, the Pope began his day by going to his prie-dieu to kneel in private prayer. Afterward he shaved and showered and dressed in the clothes the valet had laid out. A heavy woolen white cassock caped around the shoulders, white clerical shirt, knee-high white stockings, brown shoes and white skullcap. He was ready to go and see Aksa in Rome's Rebibbia prison. The meeting between the Pope and Aksa was arranged at the Pope's request, intended, he said, as an act of forgiveness. In reality, John Paul wanted to find out if what Mossad had said was true. He was driven to the prison by the very man who was at the wheel of the Popemobile in St. Peter's Square when Aksa shot him. 2 hours later, John Paul was admitted to Rebibbia's maximum security wing. He walked alone down the corridor to the open door of cell T4, where Aksa stood waiting inside. The reporters waited farther up the corridor. With them were prison guards, ready to run to Aksa's cell should he make any threatening move to his visitor. As the Pope extended his ring hand, Aksa moved to shake it, hesitated, then bent to kiss the fisherman's ring. Next he took the Pope's hand and placed it briefly against his forehead. Lei e Mehmet Ali Aksa? The Pope framed the question softly. He had been told Aksa had learned Italian in prison. Si. A quick smile accompanied the word, as if Aksa was embarrassed to admit who he was. Ah, lei abita qui? John Paul looked around the cell, genuinely interested in the place where his would-be killer might well spend the rest of his life. Si. John Paul sat on a chair, positioned just inside the door. Aksa sank onto his bed, clasping and unclasping his hands. Come si sente? The Pope's question as to how Aksa felt was almost paternal. Bene, bene. Suddenly Aksa was speaking urgently, volubly, the words coming in a low torrent only the Pope could hear. John Paul's expression grew more pensive. His face was close to Aksa's, partially shielding him from the guards and journalists. Aksa whispered into the Pope's left ear. The Pope gave an almost imperceptible shake of the head. Aksa paused, uncertainty on his face. John Paul indicated with a quick chopping motion of his right hand that Aksa should continue. Both men were so close, their heads almost touched. Aksa's lips barely moved. On John Paul's face, there was a pained look. He closed his eyes, as though it would help him to better concentrate. Suddenly, Aksa stopped in mid-sentence. John Paul did not open his eyes. Only his lips moved. Only Aksa could hear the words. Once more Aksa resumed speaking. After a few more minutes, the Pope made another little chopping motion of the hand. Aksa stopped talking. John Paul placed his left hand to his forehead as if he wanted to shield his eyes from Aksa. Then John Paul squeezed the younger man's upper arm, almost as if to thank him for what he had said. The exchange lasted for 21 minutes, and then the Pope slowly rose to his feet. He held out a hand, encouraging Aksa to do the same. The two men stared into each other's eyes. The Pope ended this moment of near-perfect drama by reaching into a cassock pocket and producing a small white cardboard box bearing the papal crest. He handed it to Aksa. Puzzled, Aksa turned the box over in his hand. The Pope waited, the gentlest of smiles on his lips. Aksa opened the box. Inside was a rosary, crafted in silver and mother-of-pearl. Ti ringrazio, thanked Aksa, ti ringrazio. Niente, niente, responded the Pope. Then he leaned forward and spoke again words only for Aksa. Then, saying no more, the pontiff walked from the cell. Later, a Vatican spokesman said, Ali Aksa knows only up to a certain level. On a higher level, he doesn't know anything. If there was a conspiracy, it was done by professionals, and professionals don't leave traces. One will never find anything. Not for the first time. The Vatican had been economical with the truth. Aksa had confirmed what Luigi Poggi had been told by Mossad. The plot to kill the Pope had been nurtured in Tehran. A few blocks from Nairobi's venerable Norfolk Hotel, the Oasis Club had long been a favorite among Kenya's business community. They could drink all night in its gloomy interior and take a bar girl to one of the rooms out back, after checking that her current medical certificate confirmed she was free of venereal disease. The club had also received other visitors, Chinese in safari suits, slab-faced Russians, and men whose nationality could have been of any country around the Mediterranean basin. These men worked for intelligence services, fighting to gain a foothold in Central Africa, where once only Britain's MI6 had secretly operated. The newcomers represented the Chinese Secret Intelligence Service, CSIS, the Soviet KGB, and Mossad. Castro had set up a full-scale operation to Cubanize the now burgeoning black liberation movement in Africa. The focus was the port of Casablanca on the West African coast. Shiploads of Cuban weapons arrived, and on the return voyages to Havana, the boats were filled with guerrilla trainees from all over Central Africa. Soon, the CSIS was helping to select them. The prospect of thousands of trained and well-armed revolutionaries being within a few hours' striking distance of Israel was alarming to its politicians and intelligence services. Back at the Oasis Club, the nights would continue as before, with new plans being made around the bamboo tables, with the rain rolling off the hills and beating on the tin roof. There was no need to whisper, but old habits died hard. But with the arrival of first Mao and then Deng Xiaoping, China's intelligence gathering, like so much else in the country, had taken a new direction. The CSIS began to expand its networks across the Pacific into the United States, Europe, the Middle East, and finally Africa. These networks were used for more than espionage purposes. They were major routes for drug running and money laundering. CSIS activities in Africa were under the local command of Colonel Cao Ling, already a legendary figure in the service, having made his reputation in Nepal and India with his subversive tactics. Based in Zanzibar, Cao Ling had a lavish lifestyle and a succession of nubile young African women as mistresses. He moved across Central Africa like a predator, disappearing for weeks at a time. His visits to Nairobi became occasions for wild parties at the Oasis. Sweet-smelling smoke from bundles of joss sticks filled the club. Delicacies imported directly from China were served. The African whores were dressed up in tiongsams. There were indoor fireworks and cabarets flown in from Hong Kong. Guerrillas who had returned from Cuba were fated before disappearing into the African bush to wage war. One of them had a party trick of drinking a glass of the human blood he drained from executed enemies he had killed. Meantime, Cao Ling was expanding his operations not only across the width of Africa, but also northward toward Ethiopia, South Yemen, and Egypt. He provided its terrorists with substantial sums of money to launch attacks on Israel. The CSIS regarded Israel as a pawn in the hands of Washington and a legitimate target for what Cao Ling called my freedom fighters. Mossad director Meir Amit decided Mossad should go head-to-head against the CSIS. For 3 years, Mossad waged its deadly war of attrition against the CSIS over the length and breadth of Africa. There was no mercy on either side. When a CSIS hit team ambushed a Mossad Katza in the Congo, they fed him to crocodiles, filming his last moments in the water and sending the footage to the local Mossad station chief. He retaliated by personally firing a rocket into the building from where the CSIS operated. 3 Chinese were killed. A later offer from the CSIS to collaborate against a common enemy, the KGB, and its terrorists, was one the Mossad chief gratefully accepted. The Chinese began to provide details about Arab movements in and out of Africa. Some were killed by the usual Mossad methods of car bombs or explosives placed in hotel rooms. On one occasion, Mossad placed a bomb in the toilet of a mercenary suffering from Congo stomach, a particularly unpleasant form of dysentery. The lower half of his body was blown to pieces when he pulled a flush in a Khartoum hotel. Mossad turned its attention to the one intelligence service in Africa it had come to look upon as a friend, the Bureau of State Security, BOSS, the most feared arm of South Africa's security apparatus. BOSS matched Mossad in blackmail, sabotage, forgery, kidnapping, prisoner interrogation, psychological warfare, and assassinations. Like Mossad, BOSS had a free hand in how it dealt with its opponents. The two services quickly became bedfellows. Often operating in tandem, they moved through Africa and joined by a secret understanding between Israel's Prime Minister Golda Meir and the Pretoria regime. The first result had been the export of uranium ore to Dimona. The shipments were carried on commercial El Al flights from Johannesburg to Tel Aviv and listed on manifests as agricultural machinery. South African scientists traveled to Dimona and were the only outsiders who knew the true purpose of the facility. Israel supplied the South African army with substantial quantities of U.S. manufactured arms, and in return was granted permission to test the first nuclear devices produced by Dimona at the site in the Indian Ocean. By then, Mossad had deepened its own relationship with BOSS. While never able to wean the Bureau's agents from their brutish methods of interrogation, Mossad instructors introduced them to a range of other methods which had worked in Lebanon and elsewhere. Sleep deprivation, hooding, forcing a suspect to stand at a wall for long periods, squeezing genitals, a variety of mental torture ranging from threats to mock executions. Mossad katzas traveled with BOSS units into neighboring black African countries on sabotage missions. Both Mossad and BOSS were driven by an obsessive belief that Africa was lurching leftward toward a revolution which would eventually engulf both their countries. To avoid that happening, any method was permissible. Feeding off each other's fears, both services gave no quarter and shared a self-perpetuating concept that only they knew how to deal with the enemy. On a cloudless morning in February 1986, 2 Israeli Air Force fighter aircraft swooped down on a Libyan-registered Learjet flying from Tripoli to Damascus. On board were Arab delegates returning from a Palestinian conference. The women on board the jet began to wail. Some of the men started to pray. Others stared ahead fatalistically. The Learjet passengers also feared this was retaliation for what had happened when another of their heroes, Abu al-Abbas, had a few months before, on October 2, 1985, taken over the Italian cruise liner Achille Lauro in what was the most spectacular act of maritime piracy the world would recall. On the Achille Lauro, Al-Abbas had murdered one of the passengers, Leon Klinghoffer, an American Jew in a wheelchair, by throwing him into the sea. Across the United States, stickers appeared proclaiming, "Don't get mad, get even." The cruise ship hijackers eventually surrendered to Egyptian authorities, who allowed them to leave, to the fury of Israel. As for the Arab Learjet, it was forced to land at a military field north of Galilee. The passengers were questioned by Amman and then released. Mossad had made a mistake. The Israelis found themselves interrogating a bunch of badly frightened Arabs. What followed from these events was a Mossad London operation which, among much else, would ruin the life of a pregnant Irish chambermaid. For it, Mossad enlisted two men. One was a Mossad katza who had served in Britain under the alias of Tov Levi. The other was a Palestinian informer, codenamed Abu. The Palestinian, Abu, had been provided with fake documents stating he was a businessman and given living expenses in London commensurate with his role as a high-flying big spender. Abu's assigned controller was the katza, Tov Levi. In every way, Abu fitted the classic definition of what a secret agent should be. He had become a familiar figure among the gambling tables of Mayfair. Given his success, his sexual appetites and bouts of drinking were tolerated. Moving in the haunts of arms dealers, wealthy Arabs, and PLO supporters, Abu picked up valuable leads. 15 PLO men were killed by Mossad over a few weeks as a result of Abu's information. Some of Abu's meetings with the katza Tov Levi had taken place in the bars and restaurants of the Hilton Hotel on Park Lane. Working there was an Irish woman from Dublin, Anne Marie Murphy. Like many others, she had been tempted across the Irish Sea by the lure of making good money in London. All she had been able to get was a chambermaid's job. The pay was low, the hours long. Anne Marie's little free time was spent in bars in the Shepherd's Bush district, long a refuge for Irish expatriates. She joined in the rebel songs and made a glass of Guinness last. Then it was back to her lonely room, ready for another long day of changing bedsheets, scouring lavatory bowls, and leaving each hotel room sparkling clean. Her career was going nowhere. Shortly before Christmas 1985, close to tears at the thought of having to spend it alone in a city so different from the carefree Dublin she longed for, Anne Marie met a dark-skinned Arab who was handsome in her eyes. In his silk suit and flashy tie, he also exuded affluence. When he smiled at her, she smiled back. His name was Nezar Hindawi, and he was a distant cousin of the informer Abu. Hindawi would lie to this trusting, naive woman. They had met in a bar close to the BBC theater in Shepherd's Bush. She had never been to this pub before, and was surprised to find Hindawi among the ruddy-faced building site navvies whose accents echoed every county in Ireland. But Hindawi seemed to know many of the drinkers, joining in their rough humor and standing around when it was his turn. For weeks, Hindawi had been coming to the bar hoping to make contact with the IRA. Abu had asked him to do so. The arrival of Anne Marie had also given him something else to think about. Captivated by his good manners and charm, Anne Marie soon found herself laughing at Hindawi's stories about his life in the Middle East. To a woman who had never traveled farther than London, he had made it sound like an Arabian Nights fantasy. Hindawi drove her home that night, kissed her on both cheeks, and left. Anne Marie wondered if the giddy feeling she experienced was the first stage of falling in love. The following day, he took her to lunch at a Syrian restaurant and introduced her to the delights of Arabic cooking. Tipsy from a fine Lebanese wine, she put up only token resistance when he took her back to his apartment. That afternoon, they made love. Until then, Anne Marie had been a virgin. Raised in the strong Irish Catholic tradition opposed to contraception, she had taken no precautions. In February 1986, she found she was pregnant. She told Hindawi. He smiled reassurance. He would take care of everything. Alarmed, Anne Marie said she would never agree to an abortion. He told her the idea had never crossed his mind. In truth, he was panic-stricken at the prospect of having to marry a woman he regarded as beneath his social class. He also feared she would go to the authorities. Hindawi turned to the one source of help he knew, his cousin Abu. Abu had his own problems, having lost a great deal of money gambling. He bluntly told Hindawi he couldn't loan him the money. Hindawi had decided he would offer Anne-Marie to return to Dublin, have the baby, and place it out for adoption. She had told him that was common in Ireland. Next day, Abu met the Katza, Tov Levi. Over dinner, Levi told Abu he needed to do something to cause the British government to close down the Syrian embassy in London and order out its staff, long suspected of being involved in terrorist activities against Israel. Central to the plot would be Abu, the cousin of Nezar Hindawi. Levi told Abu he needed a hook that would achieve that. Could Abu tell him about anyone, anything that might be useful? Abu mentioned he had a cousin with an Irish girlfriend who was pregnant in London. After his dinner with Tov Levi, Abu sought out Hindawi, apologizing for his previous indifference about Anne-Marie. Of course he would help, but first he needed to have some answers. Was she going to keep the baby? Was she still pressing him to marry her? Did Nazar really love the girl? They came from different cultures, and mixed marriages rarely worked. Hindawi replied if he had ever loved Anne-Marie, he did not now. She had become shrewish and weepy, asking all the time what was going to happen. He certainly did not want to marry the chambermaid. Abu gave his cousin $10,000, money enough, he said, for Hindawi to be rid of Anne-Marie and continue to live a bachelor's life in London. The money had been provided by Mossad. In return, Hindawi would have to do something for the cause they both believed in, the overthrow of Israel. On the evening of April 12, 1986, Hindawi visited Anne-Marie in her rooming house in the Kilburn area of London. He brought flowers and a bottle of champagne, purchased with some of the money Abu had provided. He told Anne-Marie he loved her and wanted to keep the baby. The news brought tears to her eyes. Suddenly, her world seemed a far better place. Hindawi said there was one final hurdle to clear. Anne-Marie must get the blessing of his parents for them to marry. It was an Arabic tradition no dutiful son could flout. She must fly to the Arab village in Israel where his family lived. He painted a picture of their lifestyle having changed little since Christ had walked the earth. To a girl educated by nuns, and for whom Mass had been an important part of her life, the imagery was final confirmation that she was making the right decision in marrying her lover. He and his family might not be Christians, but that did not matter. They came from the land of her Lord. In her eyes, that made them God-fearing people. Nevertheless, Anne-Marie hesitated. She couldn't just walk out of her job. And where would she get the money to pay the airfare? And for such an important meeting, she would need new clothes. Hindawi stilled her concerns by producing from his pocket a bundle of notes. He told her it was more than enough for her to buy a new wardrobe. With another flourish, Hindawi produced an El Al ticket for a flight on April 17th, 5 days away. He had bought it that afternoon. Anne-Marie laughed. "You were sure I would go?" Hindawi replied, "As sure as I am of my love for you." He promised that once she returned to London, they would be married. The next few days passed in a whirl for the pregnant chambermaid. She quit her job and visited the Irish embassy in London to collect a new passport. She shopped for maternity dresses. Every night she made love to Hindawi. Each morning, over a leisurely breakfast, she planned their future together. They would live in Ireland, in a little cottage by the sea. Their baby would be christened Sean if it was a boy, Sinead if a girl. On the day of Anne-Marie's departure, Hindawi told her he had arranged for her to collect a gift for his parents from a friend who was working as a cleaner at the airport. Her gullibility in not asking any questions about the gift was the reaction of a woman head over heels in love and completely trusting her lover. She was the perfect patsy in the accelerating plot. In the taxi to the airport, Hindawi was the loving, concerned father-to-be. Would she make sure to do her breathing exercises during the long flight? She must drink plenty of water. Anne-Marie had laughingly shushed him. Holy be to God, you think I was flying to the moon? He kissed her one last time, then gently pushed her into the line toward immigration control. Hindawi boarded a Syrian Arab Airlines bus for the ride back into London. Meantime, the unsuspecting Anne-Marie had safely passed through rough UK security checks. Next, she made her way to the high-security area reserved for the El Al flight. Shin Bet-trained agents carefully questioned her and inspected her hand baggage. She was assigned a seat and motioned through to the final departure lounge. She was handed the gift for Hindawi's parents by a man dressed in the blue coveralls of an airport cleaner. The man disappeared as mysteriously as he had appeared. Later, Ari Ben Menashe would write, "Within seconds, Anne-Marie was asked to submit to a search. The El Al security people found plastic explosives in a false bottom in the bag. The explosives consisted of over 3 pounds of Semtex. Anne-Marie sobbed out her story to waiting Special Branch and MI5 officers. It was the tale of an ill-starred woman, not only crossed in love, but double-crossed by her partner. The officers concentrated on establishing Hindawi's contacts with Syria after they realized Anne-Marie had been an innocent dupe. As the airline's bus entered London, Hindawi ordered the driver to divert to the Syrian embassy. When the driver protested, Hindawi said he had the authority to do so. At the Syrian embassy, he asked consular officials to grant him political asylum. But Hindawi left for the apartment shortly thereafter. He had gone in search of Abu. Failing to find him, he checked into the London Visitors Hotel in the Notting Hill district, where he was arrested shortly afterward. The BBC broadcast the news of how the police had foiled the plot. The details were unusually precise. The checkmate Semtex had been concealed in the false bottom of Anne-Marie's bag and was primed to explode at 39,000 feet, 336 passengers on board. Margaret Thatcher closed down the Syrian embassy. Hindawi was jailed for 45 years. Anne-Marie went home to Ireland, where she gave birth to a daughter. Abu returned to Israel, his role over. Robert Maxwell, after Hindawi's trial, unleashed the Daily Mirror. "The bastard got what he deserved," screamed an editorial. But there were intriguing questions left behind that clear-cut sentiment. Had Anne-Marie Murphy really been handed a working bomb, or had it been part of an elaborate scam? Was the man in blue coveralls, Hindawi's supposed friend, a security officer? How much foreknowledge of the plot did MI5 have? Had the real brilliance of the coup been that Mossad had achieved the diplomatic castration of Syria at no risk at all to El Al and Heathrow by using a harmless substance resembling Semtex? To all such questions, Israel's Prime Minister Shimon Peres would only intone, "What happened is usually known to those who should know, and whoever does not know should continue not knowing." From Britain's high-security jail at Whitmore, Hindawi has continued to protest he was a victim of a classic Mossad sting operation. In 1998, Anne-Marie lives in Dublin, raising their daughter, who she is thankful does not look like her lover. She never speaks of Hindawi. There is one puzzling footnote to the story. 2 weeks after Hindawi was sentenced, Arno de Borgrave, the respected editor of the Washington Times, placed his tape recorder on the desk of France's Prime Minister, Jacques Chirac. The interview had moved along predictable lines until the Washington Times editor wanted to know what stage Chirac's negotiations had reached with Syria to end international terrorism. Chirac paused and looked across his desk, seemingly oblivious of the recorder. He then said that German Chancellor Kohl had told him that the Syrian government was not involved in Hindawi's plan to blow up the El Al airliner, but that instead the Anne-Marie plot was engineered by Mossad, the Israeli secret service. The resulting diplomatic furor nearly ruined Chirac's career. He found himself being attacked on one side by his own president, François Mitterrand, and on the other fending off furious telephone calls from Helmut Kohl, demanding he must retract. Chirac did what politicians often do. He said he had been misquoted. Nahum Admoni's demise as Director General of Mossad began on a July afternoon in 1986, the result of an incident on one of those Frankfurt streets built in the post-World War II building boom in Germany. 40 years later, the street had become a mature avenue with small but well-kept front gardens and maids' quarters in the rear. Security systems were discreetly hidden behind wrought iron gates, and the lower windows were mullioned, the result of using bottle glass. Ismail Sowan's potential had been spotted 10 years before. In 1977, when Sowan was still a teenager living in a West Bank village, an Israeli army intelligence officer had interviewed him as part of a routine updating of the Israel Defense Forces profile of the area. The Sowan family had settled there in the 1930s, a time when the revolt against the British Mandate and the Jews had heated the blood of all Arabs. Everywhere there was violence. Bloodshed had begotten bloodshed. Ismail's father had joined the Palestine Arab Party, organizing protests and raising nationalist feeling in his community. At first, his fury had been against the British, but when they withdrew from Palestine in 1948, the new Jewish state became a prime target. Ismail's first remembered words were to chant hatred for the Jews. Throughout his childhood, the one word that he heard most often was injustice. It was force-fed to him at school. It filled the conversations around the family dinner table. The terrible injustice done to his people, his family, himself. Then, shortly after his 15th birthday, he witnessed a brutal attack on a bus filled with Jewish pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem. Women and children had been slaughtered by Arabs. That night, Ismail had asked a question that would change forever his thinking. Supposing the Jews were entitled to defend what they had. All else had flowed from that. His steady alienation from the violence of his companions, his belief that Jew and Arab could live together, must live together. With this came a conviction that if he could do anything to achieve that, he would. 2 years later, barely 17, he had sat down and told the IDF intelligence officer what he still felt. The officer had first listened intently, then thoroughly questioned Ismail. How could he have turned his back on all his people's beliefs, which were like a tocsin sounding a single note, that Arabs were the wronged ones, that they must fight to the death for what they believed was right? The officer's questions had been many, and Ismail's answers long. The officer noted that unlike other young Arabs living under Israeli rule, Sowan had few objections to the stringent security the army imposed. Refreshingly, the slightly built youth with an engaging smile seemed to understand why the Israelis had to do this. All that really concerned him was that the regular army clampdown meant he could not go to school in East Jerusalem to study his favorite subject, science. Sowan's file made its way through the IDF intelligence community, flagged as someone worth further investigation, finally reaching the desk of a Mossad officer. He passed it over to recruitment. Ismail Sowan was invited to travel to Tel Aviv, ostensibly to discuss his future education. He had recently applied to go to Jerusalem to study. Ismail was questioned for an entire afternoon. First, his interrogator explored Ismail's knowledge of science and was satisfied with the answers. Then the whole Sowan family history was laid bare, and Ismail's answers checked against those given to the IDF intelligence officer. Finally, Ismail was told what was on offer. Mossad would pay for his education, provided he came through his training course. He must also understand that if he spoke a word of any of this to anyone, his life would be in danger. It was a standard warning given to all Arabs Mossad recruited. But to the idealistic Ismail Sowan, it was the chance he had been waiting for, to bring together Jew and Arab. So one went through all the interview processes in safe houses before being sent to the training school on the outskirts of Tel Aviv. He excelled in a number of subjects, showing a natural aptitude for computer skills and shaking off a tail. Not surprisingly, he scored high in the subjects dealing with Islam, and his paper on the role of the PLO in the Middle East conflict was sufficiently interesting to be shown to Mossad's then-chief, Yitzhak Hofi. On completion of his training, Sawan became a bodel, a courier between headquarters and Israel embassies from where Katzas operated under diplomatic cover. He began to shuttle around the Mediterranean, regularly visiting Athens, Madrid, and Rome, carrying documents in diplomatic pouches. Occasionally, he traveled to Bonn, Paris, and London. The chance to see the world and be paid for it, he was getting $500 a month, was an exciting feeling for someone barely out of his teens. What Sawan did not realize was the documents had no importance. They were part of yet another test, to see if he made any attempt to show them to an Arab contact he might have in any of the cities he visited. During each trip, Sawan was shadowed by other newly qualified Israeli-born Mossad officers, practicing their own skills at surveillance. The person Ismail handed over the documents to, at some prearranged meeting in a cafe or hotel lobby, was not, as he imagined, an Israeli diplomat, but a Mossad officer. After weeks of spending his free time abroad, strolling around Rome's Pantheon, visiting the Sistine Chapel and exploring London's Oxford Street, he was ordered to go to Beirut and join the PLO. Enlisting was easy. He simply walked into a PLO recruiting office in West Beirut. The recruiter was intelligent and extremely well-informed in political matters. He spent time exploring Ismail's attitude toward the need for violence and whether Sawan was ready to eschew all previous affiliations, family and friends, in favor of becoming dependent upon the PLO for emotional support. He was told if he was accepted, it would mean a great change in his life. The organization would be his only protection against a hostile world. In return, the PLO would look to him to give unswerving loyalty. No one saw the person who left a plastic carrier bag in the telephone booth at the end of the street. A police patrol car spotted it and stopped to investigate. The bag contained 8 freshly minted blank British passports. The immediate reaction of the local office of the Bundeskriminalamt, BKA, the equivalent of the FBI, was that the passports were for one of the terrorist groups who had brought terrorism to the streets of Europe with a series of violent and brutal bombings and kidnappings. Representing causes and minorities from all corners of the world, they were determined to force their way to a role in setting the agenda for international policy. They had found ready support from the radical student politics which had swept Britain and the continent. Since 1968, when Leila Khaled, a young Palestinian woman revolutionary, hijacked a jet plane to London and was promptly released because the British government feared further attacks, naive students had chanted the agitprop slogans of the PLO. Those middle-class young radicals had a romanticized view of the PLO as freedom fighters, who instead of taking drugs, took the lives of the bourgeoisie, and instead of holding sit-ins, held hostages. In a few shattering minutes on the afternoon of October 21, 1967, Israel had discovered its vulnerability to modern warfare. One of its flagships, an old World War II British destroyer renamed Eilat, on patrol off the Egyptian coast, was hit by 3 Russian Styx missiles fired from Port Said. 47 Israeli sailors were killed and another 41 seriously injured, out of a complement of 197 officers and men. The Eilat was sunk. It was not only the biggest sea disaster Israel had ever suffered, but the first time in the long history of naval warfare that a ship had been destroyed by long-range missile attack. When the immediate magnitude of the calamity passed, Levi Eshkol's government ordered a crash program to provide its navy with a new kind of ship to replace the outdated Eilat. In weeks, designers had come up with a gunboat which would be fast, highly maneuverable, and equipped with electronic countermeasures to provide the precious seconds needed to take evasive action against any future missile attack. An order to build 7 of the boats was placed with the Chantier de Construction Mécanique de Normandie, a shipyard in Cherbourg, France. While they were being constructed, scientists at Dimona were manufacturing the missiles the boats would carry, together with the sophisticated equipment to be fitted once they arrived in Israel. Matters progressed uneventfully at Cherbourg, until President de Gaulle introduced a total French arms embargo after Israel commandos had attacked the Beirut airport on December 26, 1968, and destroyed 13 parked Lebanese aircraft, a reprisal for a Palestinian attack on an El Al Boeing 707 at the Athens airport 2 days previously. The embargo meant the gunboats would not be handed over to Israel. The French response ended a decade-long alliance with Israel. It had been forged during the Algerian Revolution, which had finally led to the colony's independence from France in 1962, and was partly rooted in a common hostility to Gamal Abdel Nasser's Egypt. During that time, Mossad had supplied intelligence about the anti-French FLN organization, and France had sold Israel arms and frontline Mirage fighter aircraft. With the loss of Algeria, de Gaulle had quickly restored France's traditional links with other Arab countries, and the PLO was allowed to open an office in Paris. The Beirut airport raid was seen by de Gaulle as a very public slight to his demand that Israel should not carry out what the president called revenge attacks against its Arab neighbors. The French arms embargo effectively meant Israel would no longer have sufficient replacement Mirage aircraft to dominate the Middle East skies, or be able to effectively defend itself from seaborne attack. Perversely, the embargo came at a time when Israel was grappling with the price of its stunning victory in the Six-Day War. In those few days in 1967, it had brought the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip under its control. With the land came almost 1 million Arabs, the great majority imbued with hatred for their conquerors. For me, I meet the problem Israel faced